Support for the Capital Connection comes from Clean Path New York, working to support New York's economy and bring New Yorkers renewable energy while helping to create jobs. CleanPathNY.com for information. United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Together with us once again is Albany County District Attorney David Soares, one of my favorite people in the world. Welcome back, D.A. Soares.
How are you?
Well, I'm good. You've had a lot of momentous things happening in your family, new baby, all kinds of pressures on government and watching this miscreants and how they misbehave. Yeah, I want to ask you a question. I'm writing a column for this week. I'm wondering whether or not term limits for state legislators would be a good idea.
You know, term limits to me, while they sound appealing, I find that, you know, you get accustomed to your job. The first year, usually you're finding your sea legs. It's not until your second year that you're beginning to understand the process and beginning to make differences. And to establish term limits, I think, would undermine the efficiency of government. But at the same time, we definitely need to see some change in process in the way that both our state legislature works as well as our Congress.
So, David, what do you got in mind?
I want to go back to days where we have hearings. Those hearings are open, where you have subject matter experts appearing and providing testimony. I want to see us go back to days where we're writing policy and creating policy that's based on facts and not policy that is generated, you know, for purposes of placing them on your palm card when you're running for re-election.
Sure.
And that we're not seeing headlines in the newspaper that's prompting legislators to run back to the Capitol to address very specific issues. I think that's what we've seen in the last several years, and it's not really working. And criminal justice policy is perhaps the best example of that.
You know, D.A. Soares, I'm so old that I remember a time when we were discussing whether to allow methadone to be used in New York State. And I was working for a state senator, Manfred Orenstein, and we invited Dolan Nyswander, who invented the whole thing, or who, if they didn't invent it, were pushing it. And then we invited Robert F. Kennedy. And Robert F. Kennedy came down to the hearing, and people couldn't wait to get there. I think they came by submarine, by boat, by helicopter, and every single seat was taken in that hearing room as RFK did his thing. And the minute he stopped, he left, and so did everybody else. So I wonder about whether they are fully committed to doing what they're supposed to be doing. And the more they stay, the less committed I suspect they are.
I hate to paint everyone with such a broad brush, but what I have noticed, and I've been in this position for quite some time now, and I've seen, look, I started when Governor Pataki was the governor, and you had Senator Bruno, and you had Mr. Silver, who was the speaker at the time. And I just remember there being more dialogue. I'm not suggesting to you that the motivations have changed, but it was a bit different. I do remember more engagement before major changes were made. I don't see that anymore. I see, you know, us creating policy and then tweeting about it. I learn more from social media about what's happening in our government than I do hearing from our elected officials. And so I think that's got to change. Certainly, it's been frustrating for me in my position watching all of the changes in the last several years and the impact that those changes have had in my community with the surge in violence. And so I'm hoping that upon their return, that they will begin to re-engage and we have to fix what is now broken.
David Soares, we know that a lot of Democratic candidates in the last election lost, at least that's the allegation, because the Democrats voted in bail reform. You have always raised your eyebrows about bail reform. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that.
We've known for decades that we've needed to revisit the issue of bail in the state of New York. Prosecutors and my colleagues in law enforcement, when we saw the shift moving towards bail reform, there are many of us with expertise in that area that wanted to contribute and make sure that we could shape what would be a very transparent, what would be a more equitable policy. And we were kept out of those discussions. We had more activists and more folks from the defense bar lending their voices than other respected members of, like, the Justice Task Force, for example.
So let's get this straight, David, because a lot of people who are listening say, well, I don't quite understand what this bail reform was all about. Could you talk about that for a second?
Sure. The idea that an individual who is charged, let's say, for example, with a petty larceny for stealing food from a supermarket, the idea that individual would be brought into a court, arraigned on those charges, and then kept in jail for a period of 2 weeks, a month, and even longer because bail was set at a disproportionate, amount that individual could not afford. I think we all see certainly the horrible nature of a policy that supports. And so there was a movement that has been in place for quite some time to change that. The problem, however, is what they ended up changing was a whole host of offenses, including some violent offenses, that bail can no longer be set. In addition to that, when bail is set, the judge must consider the person's ability to pay and therefore must set that bail at a very, very low amount. And that's even for violent offenses. And so the idea that here we are providing momentary relief for communities when we are capturing individuals who are engaged in violent crime, only to then set them back on the street within hours of our providing that community with relief, it's tipped the scales in favor of those who continue to contribute to violence in communities. And thus, what you see happening right now in every community in the state of New York is an increase in crimes, shootings. And I think if you scour your media sources every day, you're seeing it. And so it's broken. And I think we have to come back, admit that it is, and then make those fixes.
And what are the alternatives? In other words, you say make those fixes. What are the fixes? I mean, either everybody has an entitlement to bail, rich or poor, or they don't.
The fix is giving judges that discretion again, where they can consider dangerousness. I mean, the idea that a sitting judge whose decisions every single day impact the lives of New Yorkers cannot consider whether an individual is a danger, poses a risk to community, is just absurd. And that, to me, is perhaps the most offensive of all the changes. We elect our judges. If a judge demonstrates an error in judgment, there's a ballot box that we can certainly take that issue up with that judge. But the idea that we're preventing them from now even making those considerations is just offensive to me.
Have you spoken to the judges about this, David Soares?
Oh, we do. I mean, obviously, yeah. Because we're in the same. But again, they shrug their shoulders because it's what the law states. And that's something that I, along with the many chiefs of police and the Chiefs Association for the state of New York, are looking to fix.
I don't know how to put this delicately, but you are black. And clearly you are taking a position here which will alienate some people who will say, well, he's in a place where my son, my brother might get out, but he is espousing, he's saying that the judge should have the power to say, no, you can't get out, even though you could produce a certain amount of bail. What kind of position does that put you in, David?
Well, here's the other thing that I find troubling in our society today. And that is, in order, we don't engage in the sharing of ideas. It's not a exchange of ideas that determine how policies get made. Today, it's if you can vilify someone, you must vilify them in order to move your agenda forward. And I think what we've seen over the last several years is the vilifying of prosecutors, the vilifying of law enforcement, and only then can these ideas move forward. I am black. I come from a community that is very similar to the very community that I now have responsibilities to protect. And the idea that the idea that people of color don't want law enforcement services, or the idea that people of color want to defund the police, is a myth. It's absurd. People of color living in communities that are high, that have high crime rates, they want police services more than any community. And you know, what's frustrating is also watching people who do not live in communities that crime is taking place create policy for people who do live in those communities. So while the people who live outside of those communities share in the virtue, they certainly do not share in the burden of their policies that they're advocating for.
So the Democrats take it on the chin because they were for bail reform. They weren't going to change their minds before the election. Are they going to change their minds now?
They have to. And we told them. And there were conversations in which we told them this is going to lead to horrible results. And I think the elections in Long Island certainly captured that. I think there have been other elections giving, you know, Republicans a platform. But this was just an error that was unforced. It didn't have to get to this point. And what we've seen thus far, a colleague of mine who was a prosecutor, real tough on crime, very smart prosecutor out in Suffolk County, who lost the seat because the bail reform issues were hung around his neck. And I have to tell you, as the president of at that point in time of the District Attorneys Association, being very public and very vocal about my opposition to what was being done, there were challengers that were placed in front of me. I was primary because of my views on bail reform. But here we are now. It's 2 years later, and the consequences and the impact of what has transpired is being felt everywhere. And I'm hoping that our leaders come back and they make the necessary changes. I don't believe that we need to go back all the way, pre-2019, because I've said all along, 85% of what they did was necessary. But that 15% that is causing all of the havoc in the community, that needs to be addressed. And it's a clear and present danger now.
Well, it's very reassuring to me personally, because I like you so much and because I respect you so much, that whoever put up the primary opponent against you was defeated by your survival. But that can't be an easy thing to go through when you are taking a position of principle, doing what you need to do, I think, in great courage. And, you know, some municipal official of some kind comes along and puts up a primary person against you.
We have to get back to creating policy that is rooted in principle, policy that will, in fact, positively impact on the lives of people. I mean, look at where we are right now. We have a pandemic. The economy is where the economy is. And this is a time when people look to leadership to really help improve their lives. And the idea that we continue to come back year after year to the Capitol, where those changes can, in fact, occur, and engage in what I refer to as palm card reforms, because what you're doing is you're passing these reforms and then you're running on for re-election on those reforms, but you're not really concerned about whether what you're saying or doing is really impacting on the lives of people. It's when you see these policies that are being made with no financial support to support them that you really begin to understand that it's not about really making a difference. It's about getting reelected. And I think we need to really see a change in that culture.
What about these false convictions? A black man who's in prison for 35 years, and then they, quote, discover that he wasn't guilty in the first place.
Those are terrible. I mean, that's every prosecutor's nightmare. The idea that a person is convicted based on evidence that was unlawfully procured. And those are the things that we need to always continue to work on to make sure that those things don't happen in our practice. But, you know, this idea that we can come along and create policies that assure it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is an amazingly high standard. There is no such thing as proof to a moral certainty. And I think that sometimes that's what folks want to strive for. But, you know, we do our best. And I like the idea and where we've gone in the last decade with a number of different organizations that are out there that are reviewing these cases, that are taking these cases on. And I like the idea that there are prosecutors that are sitting in my position all throughout, you know, the country that once these issues are brought to their attention, they, in fact, move to address these issues. So I think there's a positive direction that we've gone in the criminal justice system. I just think that right now in the state of New York, with the reforms that have been passed over the last several years, we need to revisit them, make corrections.
D.A. Soares, the Supreme Court is about to rule on abortion. And, you know, I have said over and over again that I think, unfortunately, this high court has become a political body. And it leaves states like New York in an interesting position. Story on NPR just recently about how people were flocking to New York to get abortions. Does that raise any problems for you?
I will say that it is with humility that I engage with you on this particular topic, because you've been saying all along in the many conversations that we've had about the politicalization of our Supreme Court under the last president. And I love our institutions in this country. And I've quibbled with you over the years about that issue. But now, given the Supreme Court's lack of action, especially when it came to the Texas law that was passed, I'm baffled. I am baffled to see the direction of our Supreme Court. And, you know, we started off in this country with a healthy debate as to whether our country should be the United States of America or a federation of states. And we went with the United States because we wanted a country where it doesn't matter where you move to, you would still enjoy certain rights. And what I'm seeing right now happening as a result of the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States not to intervene in that Texas law is that this Supreme Court is saying to states, you know, it's really your choice. It's really your choice as to whether the Bill of Rights, as to whether any of our amendments are enforced, or you can select the ones that you choose and ignore some others. It's baffling to me that we're here at this place right now.
As I said before, you know, I have tremendous respect for you. I've known you for quite a while now. And here you are, district attorney of Albany County. Do you have any plans to run for higher office?
I don't have any plans to run for high office. I always wanted to be in service to the people of my community. And I wanted to be in service in a space that I thought I could do the most good. I will tell you, over the last several years, this has been the most frustrating period of my career. Because I take it personal when people are being harmed in communities, especially vulnerable communities. I take it very personal. And to see where we are now with identifying very dangerous people, removing violent people from community, only to see them back out in community days or hours later, it has been the greatest point of frustration for me. But this is where I feel I still can make the biggest difference in service to my community.
As a faithful listener or watcher of Law and Order, I am. I'm always interested in the relationship between the cops and the DAs. The DA is dependent upon the cops for bringing him the evidence that he needs in order to do the convictions and everything else. What is that relationship looking like in Albany now?
Well, some of these policies that have been put in place, for example, discovery, and some of the changes to law enforcement personnel records, what has happened in the criminal justice system in the last several years is the amount of material that is required now for us to turn over has put incredible strains not only on police departments, but also in district attorney offices that have to hire more people to gather all of that information and then to provide that information. And so, law enforcement agencies, for example, in Albany, there's over a dozen different agencies, and in some of the some agencies have, you know, resources, and other agencies do not. And so it has caused a tremendous amount of pressure in gathering that material. But I will say that that we've been able to adapt, and so some of these changes have been positive. But in terms of relationships with law enforcement, it's always been the case where we work cooperatively to achieve a goal. And I think you have to embrace the work that's been done, but always with an eye towards improving their work and also making sure that you're not allowing for work that is below your standards to ever permeate and find its way into a case.
So if you see, put another way, David Soares, if you see a cop doing something that is really not right, you will not be afraid or off-put by to make an arrest, for example.
These days, I will tell you that these days, when we find that a member of law enforcement has lied, we put that in writing and we submit those letters along with any other discoverable information to defense counsel. So lying or engaging in inappropriate behavior can be a career killer for law enforcement. And now more than ever, we make and we document those events and we turn that over and we make those events public.
Now, you're a lawyer, I'm not, but I'm interested in your take on treason. I think the former president of the United States is guilty of a kind of treason in that he stood up and told people to get up to the Capitol and January 6th was the result. What's your take on treason?
First of all, treason is a very, very powerful, powerful word. You know, no one should ever make allegations about treasonous behavior unless, of course, there is enough evidence to support that. What I will say about our 45th president was that he wasn't alone in treasonous behavior. There are a number of elected officials in both houses that are unindicted co-conspirators. And the idea, I mean, just listen to the conversation that we're having today. The idea that there were discussions about not certifying an election, the idea that there was an attempt to disturb the peaceful transfer of power in our country, in the United States of America, the beacon of the free world and democratic values, is an embarrassment that will take so long for us to overcome. But the damage, and sometimes I think about this. I think about it often, actually. You know, Donald Trump, to me, it happens to be one of the least. I don't think I've ever seen anyone in public life with less intelligence than Donald Trump. But what was troubling to me was the fact that there were so many people in our country so willing to follow Donald Trump. And I think it exposed all of that for us, and I think it signals to us the work that needs to be done in order to return our country and restore our country to the place that it once was.
Let me ask you about the Democratic Party. You're a Democrat. There is a so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party. There's a more moderate or even conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Where do you see yourself fitting into that paradigm? And what do you think needs to be done among Democrats?
You know, it's funny you asked me that question because I remember in 2004 when I first decided to run for office, you know, the criticisms that I received from the right was that I was too young and, quite frankly, too black.
Too black.
And, you know, almost 15 years later, 16 years later, I find myself running for another term against a quote-unquote progressive on the issue of bail and criminal justice reform. And the criticisms that were leveled at me was that I was too old and certainly not black enough. And so I think in my personal political experience, I've seen this thing shift right before my eyes. And let me just say this. Laws that should be passed to address the issues that we're experiencing in the world. It should be passed for the world that we're living in now and not the virtuous idea of a world. And I think in both, we've seen our politics shift over the course of the last year. When we had President Obama, the first African-American president, We saw, you know, almost like this magnetic attraction that pulled from the extreme right. And there are people who he gave a platform to those people, the Tea Parties. And I think with President Trump, we see him pulling from, you know, the extreme left of the Democratic Party to the point where people actually publicly uttered the words defund the police. The most absurd thing that I've ever heard in my life. We need a different, you know, group of people to enforce our laws. And I just wonder whether or not the individuals who continue to perpetuate that have actually walked through a community where violence occurs on a daily basis, whether they've actually spoken to a mother who has her children watching television in the kitchen floor because she doesn't want her kids in the living room where bullets might pierce through their windows. I just wonder whether or not those individuals who continue to perpetuate these policy changes have actually engaged with any, you know, human being outside of a classroom.
Well, David Soares, proud new father of a little baby. How much does that baby figure into the way you do your job?
I worry about the world that she will inherit, both from an environmental perspective, but also from a public safety perspective. And it's interesting you ask that question because I have old adult children as well. And I remember when my children were coming out of that sports environment, you know, going to soccer games in middle school and in high school. And I just remember how disappointed I was with the values that I saw play out in the fields where parents were yelling. They were more focused on winning as opposed to developing those character traits that we all engaged in sports to develop, you know, sportsmanship, competitiveness, but healthy competitiveness. And so I think for me, you know, this erosion of those values and even seeing it play out like on January 6th, it didn't occur that day. It's been a slow rolling erosion to the January 6th space.
David Soares, I can't say enough about my respect for you, that's for sure. You have participated in public radio, and you don't have to do that, but you do it, and I am very grateful. So we're out of time. Our guest has been Albany County District Attorney David Soares. Again, David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.